Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with the candy bomber, Gail Halverson, 95 years old but still going oh so strong. For links to his website and tons of outstanding material, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. One of the reasons this show exists is because most of us alive today weren't alive during World War II, and it helps us understand some history. And the Berlin Airlift is only a couple years after hostilities ended. So most people alive today weren't around for that either, and it's more lost in history than World War II is. Before it began, you've never heard of it. Walk us through how you became aware of what was going on there and how you got involved.
It was about 1945 at the end of the war. The way it was set up in Germany, because of the beginning of the war, they cut Germany into two pieces, the East and the West. Russians had, the Soviet Union has the East, and British, French, and Americans had Western Germany. And then the Berlin, the capital, was deep, 110 miles deep inside of East Germany. And Berlin was made up of four sectors, British, French, American, the Soviet sector. So here was an island of freedom, 110 miles deep into Soviet-controlled East Germany. It was a very unusual case. And I went to stay in the military. They asked me to stay in after the war, and I stayed in. And in that process, we'd have pilot meetings every month. And we were increasingly warned about the Soviet threat, that they hadn't disarmed like the Allies had disarmed after the war. And they were headed west, and Berlin was in the way. And then we saw the tension escalate, and we knew something was going to happen. And then they shut off all the supplies on the ground and canal system from West Berlin across East Germany to West Germany. We knew that most of the people in West Berlin were women and children, in Berlin as a whole, no matter what. Heavy losses during the war, prisoner wars, and so most of them were women and children. So I neglected to say what I felt right at that moment, because it wasn't friendly after the war, because Conrad Steffen, that I got interested in flying, as soon as Pearl Harbor, he signed up, was trained. He did get fighters. He was trained in P-47s, and he was sent to England to support the bombers over Germany. And about the fourth mission, the Germans shot Conrad down and killed him. So I had a heavy burden with the Germans and a guilty conscience. I got him started flying, and I know that he would have done it one way or another anyway. So that was a situation. And what changed totally was knowing the people were different than Hitler, and there were women and children. And so I wanted to do more. Feeling I'd left out of the heavier stuff, I wanted to do more. And I volunteered to join the airlift and was accepted. And I wasn't married by then. And I stationed at Rhein-Main in West Germany and flying into Berlin through the southern corridor. The crowd was so heavy during the startup of the airlift that all the barracks were taken. And when I got there, there was just old tar paper shacks that weren't too good. They were just being trying to refurbish some. And there was a barn, a big barn right there in Zeppelinheim, right behind mine, that had a loft in the barn, big loft, clean. And being a farm kid, I investigated the barn. It had a good floor, a cement floor under the loft. And so that was better than the old barracks they had. So me and my buddies took our beds up and slept in the barn. But even those conditions, one of my buddies in the barn had bombed Berlin during the war. And I said, how do you feel about this thing? The war's just been over. We've been home 2 years, about. So you come, and he's a family man. You come through the door, and the kids quit asking, who's that guy? You're just getting back to normal life, and then they call you back to feed the former enemy. He had been shot up over Berlin. Two of his crew members were wounded. He just barely got back to England in time to save their lives. And I said, how you feel about that? He said, well, looked far off. Says, it's a whole lot better to feed him than it is to kill him. I'm glad to be back. That's the reward a person gets from helping somebody in deep trouble. And a lesson in forgiveness, you know? How that affected, what that burden would have been, almost unbearable. But he was effective on the airlift. He did a great job. And rotating in regular time. So attitude, gratitude, and service before self is the kind of thing that the airlift brought out in people and made it possible for them to dedicate their all to it.
And I know you lived it. You flew them all those missions, and you've been talking about it ever since and reenacting it ever since, so it's old hat for you. But for someone who's hearing about the Berlin airlift for the first time, maybe you can explain what one of those missions would have been like, what you did, what you were dropping to the folks who were cut off, and what maybe challenges you faced in the process.
Well, I got over there pretty early during the after the blockade, and as I said, I slept in a barn, no water, got a light bulb from the ceiling, go through the mud to eat to the mess hall and get a shower even. And under those conditions, the morale of the guys flying was good. What we did is, first, the requirement was 8,500 tons a day to feed over 2 million people. And for the first month, we had a terrible deficit. Therefore, the schedule was we'd fly 3 round trips into Berlin from Rhein-Main and Frankfurt, and then sleep about 8 hours and do it again. So we were flying maximum. Flying C-54s like I flew to South Atlantic. That's what the schedule looked like. Now, you might start at night or you might start in the daytime. It was tough kind of getting used to the rhythm of whenever you get there, you go to bed, get after 3 round trips. And the cargo was dried eggs, dried potatoes. Of course, one plane of dried stuff could carry as much as 3 or 4 airplanes if it's not dehydrated. And, of course, flour. But we also hauled a lot of coal. They'd comment on the importance of energy. At the end, there was as much coal flowing as there was foodstuff. But it's fortunate that it began in the early summer. The weather was the best then in Europe most of the year. If it started in the winter, we'd been in real trouble. But not long after we started flying, and I got there in early July, we got radar. We had ground-controlled radar to help us stay in the quarters, the 10-mile-wide quarters, and on the long-range radar. But better than that was ground-controlled approach, GCA. The thing that really saved the airlift was radar, the approach in bad weather. And later on, we had plenty of that, ice and snow and fog. And in November of 1948, we had a real rough time. It was the first time we didn't get an increase every month. But we did better in December and January and February than we did in November. But weather was really bad then.
How exhausting was that? And what kept you going? I mean, I imagine it was fulfilling to know that people's lives depend on what you're doing and that you're helping people out that without you aren't going to have help. But do you remember what you felt during that time and what drove you, what motivated you to keep on going?
Well, the thing that motivated me the most, and of course, we were young, gosh sakes, that was good too. When we were land, being the daytime and not in a blizzard, they'd bring a certain amount of students, young students, out to the airfield. They'd escort them, and not in huge groups, but in separate groups. And see, we'd stand right by the airplane when it was unloaded. They wouldn't let us even go in the terminal building after a while, because when that airplane was ready to go, they wanted you to start the engine right away. So we stayed with the airplane. We didn't go in the building. So they'd come around, and while we were waiting for them to unload the 20,000 pounds of flour, whatever, they'd bring some kids around. And those kids would bring us even some flowers, a few flowers in the wintertime, or make a toy they made and give to you, and look them in the eye, and they'd courtesy when they left, and give us a feeling dunk for all that you do. And those little girls and little guys look up at you with those eyes, and thank you for my bread. Man, nothing. I never ever had a misgiving about that and being the former enemy. The children, to me, were the thing that wiped away all that anger about shooting down Conrad Steffen and about the atrocities that we knew were going on. And it was a new plate. The gratitude of the children, the just innocence, they were the ones that I remember this being the most motivating of any that we never hesitated to get back and get another load into Berlin. And the Brits were doing the same at Gatow and the French at Tegel. Everybody was doing it. But I think that identifying one change factor, it would be the children and their obvious gratitude.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what inspired that light bulb moment for you that led to the nicknames you carry with you to this day. Where did this idea come from to use one of these missions to drop candy for the kids?
Well, I got there in early July. As I said, I thought this airlift would be over. Stalin was getting the black eye in the world press. All over Soviets starving, over 2 million people, mostly women and children. He was losing ground. First of all, he thought it would fail. And with a fail, why? Then he'd win. But on one day, I came back from 3 round trips to Berlin about 9 o'clock in the morning to Rhein-Main, West Germany. I was supposed to go to bed and start flying that night. But my buddy, John Pickering from Mobile, had come with me. He had an airplane next to mine. Mine was empty coming in. He had one loaded about to go to Berlin. And I said, wow, this thing's going to be over pretty quick. That's how dumb I was. Going to be over pretty quick. I don't have any pictures on the ground in Berlin. I got to go to Berlin. I had a buddy with a Jeep waiting for me. If you ever get here, he says, I'll take you around and show you, get some pictures of this bombed out city. And so I told John, I told my co-pilot, go to bed, and the crew chief, go to bed. I'll be back in time to fly to Berlin. And I'm going to Berlin. And they said, you're crazy. And I said, that's okay, I'm going. So I jumped on with Pickering and went to Berlin. The Jeep was there. Before I wanted to go around the city with the Jeep, I wanted to get a picture of the approach. The approach was bad. They had this temple office built in the city. And there were high apartment houses all the way around it. So you had to come over the top or go between them. There's one place you can go between them with radar to get down to land quick enough. And I want to get the movies to come popping over those bombed out buildings. Hiked across the field to the end of the runway. Airplanes coming right over my head, but behind me, and shooting movies of them. All of a sudden, of course, there's barbed wire fence all around to keep the kids off the runway and all the way around the field. And all of a sudden, I noticed 30 kids, about 8 to 15 years old, right at the barbed wire fence on the other side looking at the uniform, and I got it with me right here, the uniform I wore that day at the fence. And those guys, kids, boys and girls, looked at it, and they were friendly. They knew what Stalin was like. They're aunts and uncles in East Berlin, just across the border, no wall. Come back and say, well, you don't even do these guys. And they knew the difference. These young kids knew the difference. They were cheering me up. Says, now look, this is good weather in July. But when the winter comes, you're going to get ice and snow. And it's going to be hard to get in here. But when that happens, don't worry about us. We don't need enough to eat. Just give us a little. Someday we'll have enough to eat. But if we lose our freedom, we'll never get it back. Kids, 8 to 40, some been probably in the Hitler Youth, some of them, and yet they knew the difference between freedom and having a managed government, going to manage your life. So those kids just blew my mind. They talked to me for about 45 minutes or almost an hour, and I said, I got to go. I had the Jeep waiting for me, take me around town. I said, don't worry about it. We'll never give up on you. Good to see you. Most of them spoke English. There's some English, and we had a translator, a kid that translated too. He says, don't worry, we never give up, and took off. Got about 50 yards, and a voice came to me, clear as a bell, you know. Wow, that was interesting. How come? And then it came to me immediately. It's the first time during the war and after that I've flown in a foreign country, the kids that age hadn't mobbed you. There's an American uniform, that's a soft touch, they got chocolate or gum, and they'd grab you going down the street in different countries. Since George Washington, troops going down the street in a different place, handing out candy to kids, that's nothing different. That's been forever. George Washington's troops did the same thing. But then when it hit me was, they had me stop dead, and not by voice inflection or body language or even any clue did they say, don't you know we like kids like chocolate? We don't have any chocolate. For a couple of years, we don't have any chocolate where we could just go buy it. And when I realized that not one child had broke ranks and they were so grateful for a flower to be free, they wouldn't be a beggar for more, it blew my mind. I just couldn't. And I said, holy cow. So I thought, I hope I got something. And I reached in my pocket hurriedly, and all I find is 2 sticks of Wrigley's Double Mint Gum. And I hesitated a minute, and I took off again.
But that's not how it ended. What happened next would change Gail Halverson's life and provide the genesis for a knockout blow in the ideological battle surrounding the Berlin airlift. One small act of kindness and compassion was met with sincere gratitude, and a worldwide phenomenon was born. We'll hear all about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.